wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, Bill Resnick continues his conversation with Jeremy Brecker about the climate crisis. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker provide an update on civil suits against big oil. And Desiree Helligers remembers Portland activist Yvonne Simmons. First up, as climate change denial dies, corporate and left programs are emerging with radically different ways for saving humanity from global roasting. Bill Resnick talks with author and Labor Network co-founder Jeremy Brecker about why the left program is superior and much more likely to succeed. Here's Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Show on cable radio in Portland, Oregon, talking to Jeremy Brecker today about the left program for saving humanity from still accelerating global slow roasting. Brecker co-founded the Labor Network for Sustainability, written some 13 books, including the classic book Strike, that's about the worker uprisings that have punctuated U.S. history and transformed the country. His latest book, Save the Humans, Common Preservation in Action, is about how social movements arise and how they change the world. Today's interview is the third installment of a long interview that explored the threat of global warming. Also, the emergence of left and corporate programs for stopping global warming and the superiority of the left program. I first asked him today to discuss the left program. He modestly responded, that's appropriate, of course. But his program that he discussed is an excellent outline of the emerging left program.
Well, I'm not sure that I can speak for the left or what the left program is, but I can certainly talk about what I think is important and what should be incorporated in anybody's program for resisting climate change in a way that leads to more democracy and more equality and a better life for ordinary folks. So I would say the first criterion that needs to be applied is it has to be effective. We are facing a climate emergency. It sounds like a cliche, but it is actually an understatement. And so the need to halt the ongoing flooding of the atmosphere with fossil fuels pollution is absolutely got to be central for any program, left, right, center, or bottom or top. If it doesn't actually radically reduce fossil fuels burning on a time scale that fits with what scientists say is necessary, then it's not it's not the program. It's not the left, right, or center program. It's a fake program. So it's very easy to see that a number of things that are being proposed and carbon captures, sucking, going ahead burning fossil fuels, but sucking all of the carbon out on its way, or even more implausible, sucking carbon and other greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. Anybody who looks at it with any kind of open mind can see that these are totally non-credible for the point of view of actually reducing greenhouse gas pollution at a level that climate scientists have said is necessary. So that's one crucial part of it. So then what is necessary is, first of all, enormous decrease in the amount of energy we need to use, and that fossil fuel energy, that can be done in numerous ways, but the amount of our pollution that is our fossil fuel use and the consequent pollution that's the result of transportation is enormous. The amount that is the result of buildings, heat loss, and mechanical systems in buildings of all kinds is enormous. And the electricity use is enormous. And those are the three largest sources of fossil fuel pollution. We have to reduce the amount of energy that we need to use and then use non-fossil fuel energy. And we need to use non-fossil fuel energy that doesn't present colossal other problems. After what we just went through with close to catastrophe of the nuclear power plant in Ukraine is just an example of the insane risks that are involved with using nuclear energy as the solution. The fact that there still is no plan for how to permanently store radioactive waste from nuclear power plants is another aspect of this. And the fact that nuclear power plants, building nuclear power plants, is absolutely insanely expensive compared with solar, wind, and geothermal sources of energy. So that's an example of we have to apply just rational scientific criteria to say that the new energy system that we're building is actually something that's going to effectively reduce greenhouse gases. So that's point one. Point two is we need to not put people in the situation where they say, well, I want to save the future and make the energy transition that we have to make, but I also have to put food on the table and shoes on my kids. And if what this means is we're going to have economic catastrophe, both the immediate loss of jobs in the fossil fuel industry, but also the inability to have an economy that creates jobs and produces the things people need, then I'm not going to cut my own throat to do that. And that's why I think, although we certainly need to make substantial changes in the economy and create both different ways of making things and changes in the things that we make, I'm very wary of a generalized idea that what we need to do is shrink the economy or make less or not have growth. It depends what you mean by growth. If growth means making just more things, more material, or making more profits for corporations and wealthy individuals, then absolutely we have to make less. But there are things that we have to make more of. At the moment, we have to make more COVID tests. I just went out and tried to buy a COVID test, and it was $15 for one test. And meanwhile, people around me are getting COVID, and I have to be sure not to spread it. That's a tiny little example. But certainly we need to be making more housing. Certainly we need to be building hospitals in rural areas and in city centers where hospitals are being closed and people are being left with no medical care. So I think the simple idea that, well, we're just making too much stuff and we have to stop is not very well considered and, in fact, can easily backfire and be used by capital in general and the fossil fuel industry in particular to say, look at these people, what are they trying to do for you? And by the way, if you read the right-wing websites and the fossil fuel industry websites, this is exactly the argument they make. The people who are trying to cut down on fossil fuels are trying to make you be poor, to make you live without gasoline, without being able to get from one place to another. That's exactly the argument they're using. And so if we're going to talk about alternatives, I think we have to talk not about just smaller or less, but we have to talk concretely about what we plan to do in order to make it possible for people to have a decent life, a better life than they have now, for a big part of our population, more things. After all, 40% of our population is living on less than $15 an hour and need more and deserve more. So I think it's a mistake to formulate it in a gross way as should we be making more or should we be making less, but rather let's make less of the things that we don't need and that hurt us, starting with the things that are destroying the climate, but also including weapons of war and including private airplanes that are further destroying the climate. And we could all make a list of those things that we should be making less of. But I think we need to emphasize also there are other things that we need to be making more of.
Yeah, I agree. I discussed the insane consumption of a small group. You're absolutely right. In fact, it's on an international basis. There are lots of people who are starving and more because of climate change, starving and living in destitution, probably 1.5 billion in complete destitution. Yeah, we also have to consider them and consider the subsidizing countries like Brazil to stop ranching in the and lumbering the Amazon rainforest. And their rainforest all over the world, the capital is exploring now, like in the Congo, another enormous rainforest. The Congolese are threatening to sell off parts of it to lumbering firms, mining firms, oil extraction. It's a really rich country, and the people are dead poor, many, many. you can't talk about degrowth in that way any more than you want to talk about the abolition of police. Those discussions are enormously damaging to any possibility of actually changing the way, quote, public safety is done, or in fact, in developing a climate action plan. And they give their corporate set wonderful talking points. And there are other ways of dealing with public safety and with climate change that are very difficult for the corporate set and the fossil fuel industries to deal with. It seems to me that one of those ways, Jeremy Bricker, is to demonstrate how there are many, many cities across the world that are either approaching, and many who have in fact succeeded in becoming zero carbon. Now, you have to take all of the claims with a bit of salt, but it seems to me that we can demonstrate that we have the technologies now, and time is really important to end the burning of fossil fuels, to change agricultural practices, to become more productive. That would, of course, hurt the agribusiness interests. They'd have to learn something new, and they like the system as it is. It seems to me that we can demonstrate that, and in our cities, we can show people right now the rooftop solar is much cheaper than any other source of, well, wind can be cheaper, actually. But wind turbines are a bit of a problem. They will be necessary for all population concentration. Some of them, most of the big cities, though, are on the coasts or big lakes or river confluences. It seems to me that we have to be able to show people that our system works. It will work quickly. It's more reliable because it doesn't need this huge grid. We can produce electricity efficiently near the point of use in almost every area of the world. Why don't you comment on that, that we have to demonstrate there are alternative works. But before we discuss that we have to demonstrate that the LEFT program actually works, we have to identify ourselves here. So this is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, our Old Mole Variety Hour. And we call the varieties and the variety of struggles from below that we cover. Bill Resnick here interviewing Jeremy Bricker of the Labor Network for Sustainability. His recent report on the network's website, Making a Green New Deal from Below, it details union efforts to deal with climate change. His recent article, Stormy Weather, Climate Change and a Divided Labor Movement, discusses the many unions going in the other direction in hopes of saving some jobs by joining the corporations to oppose climate action efforts. We asked him today to detail the LEFT program and its superiority to the corporate plan. Next, we'll continue the interview discussing the importance of demonstrating to the people of the U.S. and the world that the LEFT program works.
I'm very glad you brought it up. This is what I am mostly working on and writing about at the moment, because when you look closely, you discover that in cities and communities and states all over the country, and similar things are happening in other countries too, there is developing what I call the Green New Deal from below. The principles of the Green New Deal, that is climate protection that creates jobs and counters injustice, moves to greater equality. That Green New Deal is happening from below all over the country. And you mentioned some of the state plans, and that's part of what I am writing about right now. And you mentioned various kinds of solar. It includes rooftops on individual homes and other buildings, but it also includes things like community solar or solar gardens and solar farms, as they're known, that can provide solar energy for people whose rooftop faces the wrong way, like mine, or for other reasons are not in a position to put solar on their own rooftop. But there are ways that that can be done in a shared fashion, and the city's dimension of this that you laid out is crucially important, and there are many cities that have their own Green New Deal type programs. They may call it that or not, but they are doing not only energy production things like solar energy production, but also things like electrifying transportation, moving from individual private vehicles to public transit of various kinds, the cities are making free transit for young people, for example, and your neighbor, the state of Washington, has, I understand, just passed legislation which will have bicycle education in the schools for every student, and every student who participates in bicycle education will get a free bicycle. And the idea behind it, by the way, is not just to help kids get around or get them off our backs. The purpose of it is to build a non-car-based culture in which people will say, well, I don't really want to go by car. I'd really like to go by bicycle, or I'd like to go by public transit, and now I see that I can. So that, to my mind, is an example of the kind of creativity we need, because reducing and eventually eliminating fossil fuel production that destroys the climate is going to take a lot of creativity and the participation of a lot of people. And I mean a lot of people, like being a community effort like we've only seen in wartime, when everyone was knitting sweaters for the troops and engaging in activities that were necessary for the war effort. We need to have that kind of participation in activities that are necessary for the climate war.
Yeah. Jeremy, one other thing that should be discussed here, your green, the people of the cities or counties and in rural areas that are served mostly by public cooperatives, by cooperative entities of one kind or another, those people also are, the rural conservative farmers are in fact pushing the co-ops also that buy from big coal plants and then funnel it to all the cooperatives who have the supply lines. They're demanding to move towards renewable energy and, in fact, begin creating renewable energy all over in those localities because it's so much cheaper. Those farmers could save them half of their power costs if they went to renewable energy, and they don't have to be paying the coal barons and the coal-producing, coal generation plant owners a good deal of the resources that should go into developing your lots of things that are needed. Now, how did I get into that? Do you remember, Jeremy, what I was going towards?
Rural areas, and that they are also part of this story, and that is definitely one of the things I'm working on for the Green New Deal from below that I'm writing about. Involves many, many kinds of experiments and developments that have to do with agriculture, forestry, and of course, agriculture and forestry not only can be made less intensive in terms of using fossil fuels for fertilizer and for equipment, but they actually can effectively take carbon out of the atmosphere, unlike mechanical means that claim to do that but are extremely dubious in terms of being effective. But farming practices can make a very large contribution to taking greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. It involves especially rebuilding the soil, because soil is a great absorber of carbon, but a lot of our soil has been degraded, so it means rebuilding the soil, and it means also more obviously planting crops that are carbon negative, that pull carbon out of the atmosphere. And of course, all plants use carbon as building blocks for their existence, for their material being. So this is a very natural, but it turns out scientifically very effective way of withdrawing carbon from the atmosphere. And at the same time, we have numerous problems that have to do with food, the degradation of our food system through over-reliance on chemicals and fertilizer. So if we move in this kind of direction, along the side benefits of moving toward an agricultural system that can withdraw carbon from the atmosphere, and as well as putting less in, can also be part of making our food system healthier and making food available that's more locally grown and not so dependent on trucks and airplanes carrying it from one end of the country or from one continent to another. So that's in itself a greenhouse gas emissions reducer.
Yeah, all of the many beneficial changes in all of our systems, they're possible, they're proven, like regenerative agriculture that you just described. But as you pointed out, it's going to take people to participate in these struggles, and it has it in it that added attraction, it seems to me, for the left is that in that participation, people become more and more committed to sort of democratic engagement and capable of doing it. And that's, it seems to me, is a crucial goal for all global societies that are now facing these media onslaughts that are devoted to transforming people from decision makers and thoughtful to consumers, where life's satisfaction are found not in work, not in creativity, but in getting new goods, which of course is ultimately becomes a deeply demoralizing life direction. It seems to me that this democratic engagement within those cities is important for any program that wants to maintain the ecosystems upon which our lives depend. And it's so good for almost everybody, but the people who want to accumulate riches as their life passion. Jeremy, you get the last word.
Well, I'd like to say that I think you're pointing out the centrality of democracy to creating all the other changes we need is crucial. And I think we have to combine that with what more and more people are recognizing, which is even the flawed democracy that we have is under very serious threat. We saw that in the attempt to overcome the last presidential election, to overthrow the results. We see it in the insurrection that took place January 6th in the Capitol, but more decentralized. We see it in the exclusion of all kinds of people from access to voting and the increased gerrymandering and other distortions of democratic structure. And I think that part of the struggle for all the things that we need, climate protection, but also for health care, for housing, for civil rights, these are all entwined with the struggle to preserve and extend our democracy. And I agree with you completely that what happens at the local level in the city, in the county, in the state is a crucial building block for rebuilding our democracy.
That was Jeremy Brecker discussing the Left's program for saving humanity from global roasting and continuing the human experiment. He began modestly saying, "I'm not sure I can speak for the Left." Then he offered his ideas, which for me is an excellent outline of the Emerging Left program. So, Jeremy Brecker, writer, activist, keep up the great work. I'm looking forward to the book you're writing now. And for our audience, tell us how to get, well, Strike is available in any decent bookstore. Save the Humans, Common Preservation in Action. It's a wonderful book, and it deals in detail with some of the things we are talking about today, many of them.
Many of my books are available for free download on my website, which is simply www.jeremybrecker.org. And the ones that aren't there for download, you can find out where to get them. So it's www.jeremybrecker.org.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy.
Thanks, Bill. Good to be with you.
DJ Format on the Old Mole Variety Hour, the track titled Time to Listen, followed Bill Resnick talking with Jeremy Brecker. Up next in their Left in the Law segment, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discuss civil suits against Big Oil and report on a congressional hearing in September targeting the fossil fuel industry and its history of deception. around climate change. Here's Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Last month, there was news on two fronts in the David and Goliath fight against big oil. Civil cases by states against fossil fuel companies continue to move at a glacial pace through the courts. But the lawsuit by Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison to hold large fossil fuel firms responsible for deceiving the public on climate change emerged as a campaign issue. On another front, a congressional hearing over the oil industry's false claims about the role of fossil fuels in the climate crisis, a similar issue, generated a trove of new internal documents proving the sociopathy of the oil giants and their lobbyists. So, Mike, where to start? You want to start with the congressional hearing, which was, of course, the biggest news last month.
Well, Congress has been acting in this area, just like they have in the area like criminal justice or any other area, far more effective, better results than litigating in courts. I mean, this committee hearing that you're talking about, Committee of Oversight and Reform, is remarkable. They have subpoenaed thousands, tens of thousands of emails, documents. They've called people to testify, and they have shown conclusively that not only is big oil a very complicated villain, because everyone, that is, uses their products every day, has been deceiving everyone as to the effects of this oil that they're selling us, and that they've been knowingly deceiving us. And the committee's hope is that big oil would convert into green energy firms. And it's not totally irrational, given that they've got networks of distribution, they've got huge amounts of capital, they could do that. And in Europe, a couple of the biggest oil companies are spending real money in order to transform themselves. But none of the companies here, like Exxon or Chevron, are doing anything remotely like it. Instead, they're cashing in this incredible windfall, making billions of dollars every week that's been provided them by the Russia-Ukraine war.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the shift in the hearing from October 2021. This is a year-long investigation carried out by this House Committee on Oversight and Reform focused on the fossil fuel industry. The hearing title was Fueling the Climate Crisis, Examining Big Oil's Prices, Profits, and Pledges. So that's a very different declaratory title for the hearing that suggests it's presenting its findings that are more damning than the more tentative hearing from about a year ago. And in this hearing, they also brought many people to testify who are feeling the effects of the fossil fuel industry, the health effects, also brought up the issue of exploiting the war for their obscene profits. So there were a number of themes here and political arguments that emerged this year that was quite different from the hearing over a year ago. What do you make of that? Well, is it that it's the result of a year-long investigation and now they're presenting more damning findings, or is it also in response to some political shifts?
Well, I think they've been very resolute and determined and busy for a whole year, and they've done remarkable work. The sad thing is that no one knows about it. You know, it's a sort of reenactment in real time of the movie Don't Look Up, because as the news every night guesses about whether or not President Trump is going to run for office or be thrown in jail, these people have been coming up with solid facts about how we've been deceived, how many people have been hurt, exactly how they've been hurt, what needs to be done to stop it, and how cataclysmic it will be for everyone if we don't stop it. And their report to me is just breathtaking because it nails them. You're right. It's uncompromising language. They're not trying to get along with anybody. They're trying to tell it exactly like it is. And they're doing so very forcefully.
So their powers, though, are quite limited. I mean, this is a subcommittee on the environment and they have some review role, but their powers are limited, it seems, to their ability to pass on their findings from the investigation to other bodies or groups that can do something about it.
That's it. They can't confiscate funds. They can't redirect funds. They can't put anybody in jail. They can't do much of anything except shape the narrative. And they can provide facts for narratives, for stories. They provide the stories themselves. They explain what's going on. They are a source, a really valuable resource of information. If you want to know what's happening, why it's happening, who's trying to hide it, they've got all those names and dates.
I think it's also interesting how the climate activists have emerged in these documents as targets of the oil industry and their executives and lobbyists, which in a way, I think, brings climate activists onto the stage of their consciousness and also brings climate activists into this David Goliath struggle as part of the drama. It's not just about the regulatory potential of the government, but they are clearly targeting climate activists. And there was a lot of discussion of gaslighting the public, but also of wishing harm to climate activists. And
not only harm, bed bugs.
Oh, that's like an extreme form of torture. Yeah, as a psychoanalytic person, I'm always interested in the metaphors people select and what it projects about their own, perhaps their interest in getting into bed with people in the government. They've been in bed with so many people to get their own way, and now they're climate activists are not such good bedfellows.
Well, that's true. The Sunshine Project people, Bill McKibben, all kinds of people are driving them nuts. So beneath the soothing greenwashing language of their annual reports and their press releases, they're really upset, and which is it's a great comfort to know that your efforts have not been as in vain as you might think, because their reactions privately are really strong and somewhat fearful.
Yeah, Barashini Prakash, executive director of Sunrise, in response to the hearing, said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they wish bedbugs on you, then you win. And I'm not so sure about the winning part, though. What's your assessment of what can be achieved through these revelations that have depended often, like with the tobacco industry and the pharmaceutical industry, and establishing a record of deceit, deception, and knowingly presenting to the public a message that departs from what you know privately to be true?
Well, we've had actually a remarkably good run in the legislature the last year or two. There's been the Inflation Reduction Act. Not only, it has some bad things in it.
Yeah.
The worst thing just got foiled in September when Joe Manchin was required to drop a process of fast-tracking pipelines and other invasive activities by the fossil fuel companies.
Right, which came out of coordinated massive political pressure all around the country by activists to.
It really did.
Yeah.
And that law also had hundreds of billions of dollars of solid investment in alternative fuels. It already, investment from Australia and from Europe has been coming to the U.S. because of huge tax advantages given to people who develop alternative fuels, particularly green hydrogen, which is basically water broken into its parts by the use of solar and wind energy. There's lots of really great things happening. And I must say the Democrats are breaking away from the bipartisan consensus. And they remain, of course, strongly allied with fossil fuel companies, but they've done significant steps forward because of all the various pressures that they and only they are subject to. If the Republicans recapture the House, there won't be any more hearings exposing internal documents of Exxon and Chevron. There won't be any more monies allotted to alternate fuels. That'll be cut off. So it's a really significant time. I mean, so often the bipartisan ruling class of this country that gets enormous defense budgets passed routinely, that gets favorable banking bills passed by all sides, and gets fossil fuel support at every level, that consensus is breaking down. There seems to be great legislative effort, which, let me say, is completely contrary to what's happening in the courts.
So before we close, let's return to that civil cases going through the courts. We've reported on those before. And the important work of Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison on this front, as well as other cases. Can you say a bit about why those cases slog along so slowly and whether they're, you know, worth their weight and whether his opponent, this Jim Schultz, was correct in saying this isn't going to go anywhere. It's a waste of time.
Well, the fact that Keith Ellison's Republican opponent came out against it was the best thing that's happened on this front because the courts have essentially ignored it. What's happened is we've got an increasingly conservative judiciary at every level. We've got Exxon now has infinite amounts of money and time, and they have hired some of the most expensive lawyers in the country with vast resources to do depositions and review millions of pages of documents and generate billions of pages of documents, all designed to stop this kind of litigation. And they've been very successful. Keith Ellison's lawsuit, really well put together, which we enthusiastically described a couple of years ago, is totally stuck. They're litigating the question of whether it will be heard in state court or federal court. And that question is going to consume a decade.
And the federal court is what the oil industry wants, because that's the death of these cases, isn't it?
Well, generally so. You know, the federal judiciary has had, you know, is saturated with Trump appointees, and it generally is more favorable. But they want to really avoid the state courts, because state courts can be far more conservative, but they can also do striking things. They can really strike hard blows of money, and even more importantly than money, which Exxon now has an infinite amount of, restrictions on their behavior.
Are the standards of proof different at those levels? What's required to prosecute a civil suit?
Well, it's not really the target goal. The goal of Exxon is to hang it up. They don't care that much where the final forum is. They want it to live in suspension between forums. That's where they like their lawsuits to be.
Okay, well, we'll continue to follow these cases, and hopefully the climate justice movement can push the right places and continue to make, I was going to say mountains out of these molehills, make strides on this front. So,
well, we've got great activities in legislatures and states and the federal level all over the country, and that's where there is give. That's where we should push. And I'm sorry to say that the judiciary is you should never give up on these cases, and maybe there will be a breakthrough. There'll be a new judge and a shift in climate somehow that will allow these cases to proceed. But right now, all the action is with your representatives.
And as you're saying, although there are profound limits to the Democrats and even progressive Democrats, but there also are places where progressives can press and push to make things happen that will be much more difficult if Republicans take over this fall.
That's true.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Mike. We'll stay tuned.
We will.
Of Mexico way. There's something gone wrong, so the papers all say. A Mexican oil well is leaking its goo. They say it's the worst that things have ever come to. Yes, it's gallons of sludge, 60 million and more. It's cruising and oozing towards many a shore. Yes, things have got bad, but they'll probably get worse. If you can't drink the oil, oh, you might die of thirst. Because it's oil, it's oil, and it's creeping in the sea. Oil, oil, don't buy it at the station. You can have it now for free. Just come on down to the shoreline where the water used to be. Yeah!
That was The Oil Song by Steve Forbert, following Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Finally, this episode, Desiree Helliger's reflects on the remarkable life and legacy of Portland activist Yvonne Simmons, who passed away in July. Here's Desiree Helliger's for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Listen to the women, hear our voices, study our lives and trust our choices. Sit with a woman as she labors to give birth. Take her hand and promise her you'll work her life on earth. And we'll listen to the women for a change. Listen to the women for a change. Listen to the women, hear our voices, study our lives and trust our choices. Listen to each woman as she tells of pain and hurt. Help her every way you can to work for peace on earth. And we'll listen to the women for a change. Listen to the women for a change.
That was Listen to the Women for a Change by Betty McFarland, sung by the late, great Yvonne Simmons and the very much still alive and kicking Mary Rose, the Portland folk duo Simmons-Rose. On September 25th, friends and chosen family gathered to honor the wild, courageous, unbelievably creative life of Yvonne Simmons. A teenage runaway and London street kid, Yvonne would go on to become a folk singer and international peace activist with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, Women in Black, and the Clothesline Project. And she was a founding member of Portland Peace and Justice Works, Portland Cop Watch. Yvonne died on July 2nd following a nearly decades-long struggle with dementia. In this segment, I reprised the eulogy I gave for Yvonne on the 25th, and we hear audio excerpts from the memorial from Yvonne's longtime friend and collaborator, Dan Handelman, and audio of Yvonne from interviews with or produced by the Flying Focus Video Collective. There's a poem by Mary Oliver called The Summer's Day that seems a fitting memorial to Yvonne. I don't know what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel into the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done?
Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Yvonne definitely knew how to fall down into the grass.
One of her favorite songs was, I Am a Wild Woman. And for Yvonne, that was her credo, her article of faith. And living her life like it was wild and singular, wild and precious, was something she excelled at. Her incredible spontaneity, her penchant for interrupting conversations with songs, her playfulness were qualities that could not be beaten out of her, though people tried to do just that at times, both literally and figuratively.
Yvonne was a survivor.
But she was so, so much more. She was a role model, mentor, surrogate mother, and deeply loyal friend to so many. She was an artist, and life was the medium at which she most excelled, but she also made jewelry and was a gifted fiber artist. Yvonne understood very personally the links between war and violence against women. She was a comedian, a world traveler, a videographer and producer with Flying Focus Video Collective. She was a founding member of Portland Peace and Justice Works Portland Cop Watch. She was a counselor and ordained mail order minister who presided over the marriages of dear friends, but also the occasional canine couple.
Yvonne loved a good dog wedding. I love life was Yvonne's often spoken mantra, and that love was hard fought for. Yvonne was born in 1946,
when bombed-out buildings were still very much part of the landscape of London where Yvonne grew up. She often spoke of how she grew up playing in those bombed-out buildings, how as a small child she accompanied her mother to aid agencies when they had no food, and she talked about how her very loving mother had been forced for a time to place her and her sister at a church-run children's home, where 7-year-old Yvonne had to fend off a pedophile minister, leaving her with a lifelong aversion to organized religion. Yvonne was all of about 13 years old when she ran away from home, fleeing sexual abuse, an experience she frequently recounted as if each repetition might somehow exercise the memory. Yvonne eventually settled in the Italian resort town of Fregene, about 30 miles from Rome, where she sang at a piano bar and was often accompanied by her howling dog, Blacchino. The bar was frequented by Fellini and other luminaries of the international film scene. Yvonne would go on to hitchhike across the Middle East and crew a sailboat across the Atlantic, accompanied, of course, by her navigator, Blacchino. Yvonne arrived in Portland in the 1970s, where she married David Losh and formed an indelible friendship with her mother-in-law, Pat Hollingsworth. Yvonne and Pat became inseparable, and it was Pat who introduced Yvonne to the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. The two would organize together for decades. Working to end war and violence against women was an animating drive in Yvonne's life. Here's an excerpt of Yvonne and Mary Rose singing Peggy Seeger's song, The B-Side, which imagines a world in which men are routinely menaced by women in the same way that women are by men.
There's something I've always wanted to say to you men. How would you like to hear this warning again and again? Look out, beware, take care, be careful whatever you do. Watch every step you take, or something could happen to you. Suppose that boys were made of sugar and spice, and girls were snails and puppy dogs' tails, and nothing that's nice. They'd turn into women whose needs would be terribly hard to control. Then you'd have to dress and behave like prisoners out on parole. Men, watch out, there's dangerous women about. Boys, beware, there's violent females everywhere.
Yvonne would go on to produce some 25 videos for the Flying Focus Video Collective, videos that focused variously on militarism, poverty, and violence against women. Yvonne attended and documented international women's conferences. She organized against both the First and Second Gulf Wars, helping to organize some of the largest peace demonstrations in Portland's history. If Yvonne was sometimes on the stage and at the mic, even more frequently, she'd be there at the crack of dawn helping to set up the stage, the canopies, and the tables. Yvonne's commitment to ending war and violence against women led her to risk her life to bring aid to women and children under siege in Sarajevo in the 1990s, where many of the women that she worked with had survived horrific sexual violence. Yvonne was honored for that work when she was named Woman of the Year by the Oregonian. When she was medically evacuated during her final trip there, she suffered brain damage as a result of a medical procedure gone wrong. If her brain injury, called central pontine myelinosis, was a condition that people rarely recovered from, the same woman who dodged snipers and mortars in Sarajevo somehow survived and over the course of several months learned to walk and talk again. Yvonne's animating passion to end war and violence against women would lead her to bring the National Clothesline Project to Portland, where it was hosted by PSU's Women's Studies Department, and where Yvonne could be found on the park blocks holding down a table where survivors of abuse decorated T-shirts that witnessed their abuse, their anger, grief, and resilience. That same animating commitment led Yvonne to create and host a camp in Northeast Portland where arts-based activities emphasized to the kids that hands are not for hurting. Yvonne was a perennial presence also at Pioneer Courthouse Square, standing vigil with women in black, and she was active also with Code Pink. Though Yvonne had no biological children, she helped many friends raise children and was a life-changing mentor to many, including myself and Dan Handelman, who also eulogized Yvonne at the memorial. Here's Dan Handelman talking about Yvonne Simmons.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Dan Handelman. I am a member of a group, Peace and Justice Works, and I was there with Yvonne when we started this group in 1992. I met Yvonne in 1991 during the so-called Gulf War, and she was walking at the peace marches with her dog, Mischief, who was wearing a T-shirt that said Peace Dog on it. In her later years, Yvonne developed dementia, and she was under the care of Emerson House. It was very, very kind to her. And the benefit of her having a memory loss is that I got to remind her a bunch of stories of her life, kind of some of which Desiree's touched on already, that made it so that I had to tell her these stories over and over again. So now you get to hear the same thing I would tell Yvonne every time I went to visit her to remind her about her life. And I think Desiree might have mentioned that at one point Yvonne sailed across the Atlantic, and she also, at that piano bar in Italy, Yvonne told me that she had engaged in she called a reverse striptease. She would put more clothes on every time the music changed up. So I thought that was hilarious. Very keeping with Yvonne's sense of humor. I reminded her how she would help women and children in other countries. She went to Yugoslavia, I think, 7 times, and then and to Peru. She helped children in poverty there who lived in a garbage dump. And she brought video back from those trips, some of which we used at Flying Focus. Desiree kind of briefly also mentioned one of Yvonne's amazing abilities is that she could walk down Sniper Alley and dodge the bullets. And even when she got this brain injury, the central pontine myelinosis, she was able to recover when the doctor said that nobody recovers from that. She just had this amazing, Energizer Bunny kept going no matter what. And the peace camps that Desiree talked about, not only did she do them here, she also taught kids in other countries, and she learned to sing songs in other languages. Part of her mischievous side, I would remind her, is International Women's Day. They went to the MAX train, the light rail here in Portland, and added I-N-E to the end of the name, so it was called Maxine for that day, to feminize it. Another thing, you know, just her ability to get things done that you wouldn't think anybody could get done includes that she was able to get Cholito into this country. He was born on that garbage dump in Peru. And, you know, it must be amazing amount of paperwork to bring an animal in from another country, but she managed to do it. She, in Yugoslavia, she brought shipping containers full of aid there for women and children. And she had to work with the military, the U.S. military, to make that happen. And she told the woman in the military that they were talking about whether or not gays should be allowed to be in the military. And she said, I don't think they should be in the military. And the woman said, I know you. You don't want anybody to be in the military. And Yvonne would laugh because that's exactly what she meant. She didn't think anybody should be in the military. A funny comment that she made frequently was that, you know, you heard about her marriage to David and her close relationship with her mother-in-law, Pat Hollingsworth. She used to joke that she wished she had married Pat instead. And for those of you who don't know, both their names, Yvonne and Pat, and several other members of the local Wilf, are etched in a walk of heroines and in front of the Hoffman Hall at Portland State University. When she was on the board here at Peace and Justice Works, she would joke that of our five-member board, I was the token man, which is kind of funny because there are a lot of groups where the majority of the, you know, leadership or whatever is male, and I was the only man on the board. So the first clip we're going to see is from one of the very first shows we produced at Flying Focus about the Clothesline Project that Desiree referenced. There's a song that I think is recorded with her and Mary Rose playing at the beginning, and then you'll hear her describe a little bit about the Clothesline Project.
How could anyone ever tell you that you're anything less than beautiful? How could anyone ever tell you that you're less than whole? How could anyone fail to notice that you're loving? How deeply you're connected to my soul.
Hi, I'm Yvonne, and we're at Peninsula Park at the showing of the clothesline display, which memorializes the violence against women. T-shirts are hung on a clothesline, and women draw on them about the violence that has happened to them, whether it's battering, rape, or incest. And with me is Georgia, Mary Rose, Pat, and Fran Petchek. During this time, you will hear a gong being banged, and that will go every 20 seconds, saying a woman is being battered. Then every 3 minutes, a whistle is blown to say a woman is being raped. And every 20 minutes, a bell is rung. That says that a woman has been murdered.
Yvonne did travel a lot, and she went back to England to join women who are protesting a U.S. spy base there called Menwith Hill. She recorded a program early on about that spy base and then went back again to visit the women's encampment near there. So what you see is a clip from that second show.
Menwith Hill. It's not marked on any of the maps. It's the most secret United States base in Britain. It's the world's largest spy base, and it's getting bigger. It's the hub of the U.S. military planning in the Northern Hemisphere. The Menwith Hill spy base near Harrogate is run by the National Security Agency, NSA, of the United States. It employs around 1,200 staff, mainly American, who are ordered never to mention the NSA and to report all contacts with foreign nationals, and that's the Brits.
You've been listening to a segment about the London-born Portland peace activist and folk singer Yvonne Simmons, who died July 2nd after a nearly decade-long struggle with dementia. Keep an eye out for a follow-up segment celebrating the life and times of Yvonne Simmons while we reflect back on 5 decades of Portland organizing. This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mall Variety Hour. We're playing out this segment with Simmons Rose singing the Overflowing Catbox Blues by Jane Robinson.
I've got the nobody loves me, nobody feeds me, Overflowing Catbox Blues. I've grown gaunt from deprivation and want, but cat food I don't deign to take. How gauche!
but I could connive to completely revive. When you've given me half of your steak, Dunrare, I'll sit here and beg with my claws in your leg until you concede what I'm due. I've got the nobody loves me, nobody feeds me, overflowing cat box blues. Hey, I don't deserve this lousy door service. I'm always on the wrong side, you know this. Growling and meowing, mewing and yowling works, but it hurts a cat's pride. So I'll just claw and I'll spray till the door rots away and it gives me a hole to pass through. I've got the nobody loves me, nobody feeds me, overflowing cat box blues.
This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for October 31st, 2022. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Desiree Helligers, Jan Hocken, Mike Snedeker, and Bill Resnick, and to their guests Jeremy Brecker and Dan Handelman. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of the Old Mole in time at kboo.fm. Just search for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.